Once more into the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Sometimes, and it is exciting.
Sometimes more exciting for us than for the rest of the world. And people go, why are you guys so excited? Well, we don't know if we're on the air sometimes.
And we don't know if we're about to say something incredibly stupid that will haunt us for the rest of our lives.
Or maybe it's more like, we know we're about to say something incredibly stupid and we're constantly keeping ourselves from doing it.
Oh.
Maybe.
So you know the future?
Predictions are really tricky, especially about the future. And
The
future's not what it used to be. And
Give a sight for that. I mean, you got it.
Yogi Berra, I'm misquoting him twice.
Oh, good. That's tremendous.
I paraphrased two times, Yogi Berra.
Actually, the first guy that recorded to have said that, in not exactly the same words, was Sir Isaac Newton. Forecasting is particularly difficult when it is about the future.
Mm.
So, smartest guy, arguably one of the smartest guys who ever lived, said that. So, that's cool. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And this is a radio program where we talk about things economic.
Sometimes a podcast, too.
Yes. And it's sometimes a podcast. Well, we don't know what it is. As usual, we're confused. We talk about things to do with investing and building a portfolio. We do not give advice about what you should buy and sell specifically, because that would be investment advice. And the name of the Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas. And it's registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which implies in no way that they approve of us.
They don't approve, just period.
They don't they don't approve of much of anything, which is their job. And we don't give investment advice on the radio program. We do give educational information, and the educational information we give has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. See, I can say that really quickly.
You've done almost all the disclosures yourself. You got one more. Let me see if you can.
We don't pay for this radio program. Woo-hoo. We don't get paid to do this radio program or podcast, as the case may be. We do have an interest in it, in that apparently a lot of our clients listen to it. And so it's a way of communicating with our clients. And occasionally we hear from people who aren't clients who have listened to it. And on extremely rare occasion, they ask if we would manage their money. But we've done a cost-benefit analysis on that and concluded it is advertising. Our time isn't worth this.
Yes.
Our time is worth more than this. That's right.
That's not why we do it. We're hoping to actually educate the population, which is, we don't mind it if people become our clients, just to put that lightly. But that's not why we're doing this. We want you guys to understand what's going on in the world. That's the only last piece is that we do pay for advertising on KTEM 1400, which is the same station that broadcasts this. But the advertising that we're paying for is advertising for the radio program, which the studio also does in partnership with us. So
it gets our name out there.
It does get our name out there as well. So,
You know, it occurred to me that we are ESG.
It depends on how you labeled. Well, that's the
whole
thing with the
ESG.
Yeah, so we are ESG.
We're economics, securities, and regulated by the government.
I thought you were going to say goobers. The last.
Well, that's true. Well, that would probably be more accurate to say we're goobers.
We're economic stock oriented goobers. Yes, ESG, 100%.
Securities-oriented
goobers. Yes.
Yes, so we're ESG. We can say we're ESG.
I mean, I've got lots to talk about on the ESG front later on.
Okay.
I've got
we got a stack of questions.
Man, we've got questions, good questions, too, coming out of our ears, or at least out of our emails. Starts with an E. But before we get to that, what's happened in the market this week? Some major stuff.
Well, it was a historic week in that the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, Dow Jones Industrial Average, both crossed into official bear territory, except that there's no official to officiate where a bear is. But it's kind of the media kind of generally says, okay, when it's 20%, when the indices, not counting dividends reinvested, are down 20% from their recent peak, then we're in a bear market. So the news media was full of pundits talking a lot or writing a lot about that we're in a bear market, and what the implications are of a bear market is if the difference between 19% and 20% was that big.
Let me say this clearly. There was a time when the spelling of a word didn't have rules around it. You could just write it however mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. wanted to. And then we had dictionaries made. And these dictionaries came out and basically self-appointed correctors of everyone else's spelling.
Mm-hmm.
That, which seems pretty arrogant on the surface of it. I'm going to tell everyone else how to spell these words. You guys don't know what you're doing, but we accepted it. And so now when you play games like Scrabble, you can look it up on a dictionary, but there's not a standard dictionary that everybody goes to anymore. There's a lot of them. There used to be several standards. Johnson did a book, a dictionary, and then Webster's came out. So you could go and look at a standard and say, this is what the definition of this word is. I think that standard now is Google. Would you agree with that?
Probably either Google or Microsoft.
So when you do a search for what is a bear market, Google answers. Now they are answering using someone else's voice. In this case, CNBC is, according to Google, the highest authority on what a bear market is, at least at the moment. And it says a bear market is a decline of 20% or more from recent highs. Now, it doesn't tell you how recently you should be checking, just recent highs.
It's not a very very specific definition.
Yeah. So recent highs being the most recent highs, the highs of the highest it got recently. Maybe it's hard to, but that's what we're saying, is that there's not a universal official bear market, except that sort of there is. So officially, we're in a bear market. There.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there's a consensus.
Yes. We've all sort of agreed, but I could call this a turkey market if I wanted to.
There's
nobody preventing me from doing that.
Yeah, but then you'd have to be a pundit to officially designate a bear market, I think.
All my puns leave dents.
That makes sense. Anyway, we are in a bear market, which, for whatever it's worth, does the S&P 500 stock index is down 23.33% from its high, I think it was January 3rd. It's down 11.8% from a year ago. It's still up 25% from this time 3 years ago, and I think up about 50% from where it was 2 years ago in March and March 2020. So what's the big deal? Well, the deal is we have these from time to time.
Bears. Yeah. In fact, we used to have them about every 4 years.
And I am of the opinion it's a really good thing to have.
Yes.
And the reason it's a really good thing to have, it's kind of like a forest fire. If you go a long time without a forest fire, you get a lot of dry stuff built up on the floor of the forest and so on. And we experimented with that across the national forest by stopping forest fires. And when you do finally get an uncontrollable forest fire, as it will be uncontrollable at some point because of the amount of dry wood and stuff built up in the forest, it really does a lot of damage. So going a long time without a bear market or without a recession is not at all good for the market or the economy. Is it unpleasant? Oh, absolutely. But it tends to shake out the stupid stuff. There is an abundance of stupid stuff at any given moment in a market. There's a superabundance when we get into long-running bull markets. We get zombie companies.
Yeah.
And there are zombie companies out there. Morningstar listed quite a long number of them, quite a long list of them.
Now, let's give a definition of a zombie company real quick.
A zombie company is a company whose debt service exceeds its profits. In other words, if they took all their profits and they turned them around and put them into just paying for interest rate, their interest and their principal that they have to pay off on loans, they couldn't do it. So they survive by borrowing more money. And if interest rates are low enough and loaners are dumb enough, they continue to loan to these companies with the thought that sooner or later, this company will make a profit. Now, when did we last see that? We saw a lot of it in the 1990s, and drcoop is probably .com. And
yeah.
The .coms who weren't making money had no plans by which they would make money, but were still functioning. And they had when you hear about burn rate, that means they're going through the money they borrowed or investors have given them, and they're not making a profit. There were a bunch of those last year. a bunch, which is an economic term, yes, which means it's a substantially large
number. It's a highly technical term, a bunch, but we use it regularly.
Do we have a bottom in this bear market? Probably not, but you never know. Bear markets are weird things like everything else.
We'll have a bottom eventually.
But we typically...
We may not be there
historically.
Yet. Yeah, we may not be there yet.
Historically, there is a panic that takes the bear market down substantially, which, by the way, it did. There was a sudden sell-off on Thursday of this week, which could have been the panic, except there's an index called the VIX that indicates just exactly how panicked people are. I'm not sure how they figure that out, but they do.
It's a volatility index. It looks at ranges of movements up and down and all of the stocks of the market.
It had room to peak on Thursday, but then it stabilized on the rest of Thursday and Friday, which means that there is no major selling panic, which means it's probably not the end of the bear market. The end of a bear market historically has normally been when the people who are very, very nervous and very, very scared, but they're not selling and they're gritting their teeth and they're hanging on by their fingernails, finally throw in the towel and sell. That is an indication that they're at the bottom.
That has a term for it. It's called capitulation. When you see capitulation in the market, it means that suddenly it's like all the strings got cut at once and you see a free fall for a certain period of time that kind of stabilizes. We saw a little bit of that on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had a movement upward on Friday, and that's not normal for bottom. Usually at a bottom, you see a drop on Friday because there's a bunch of news that could come out over the weekend that could hurt you. So we saw that up. Oh, wait a minute. How many hands do we have?
I've got at least two.
I got to take a shoe off. Hold on a second. Yeah. Go ahead.
On the other hand, picking the bottom point in a bear market is not a science. So every bear market is a little different. And some of them are a lot different.
I don't know what you're talking about. I can call the bottom of every bear market that we've had over the last 100 years.
Yeah, but not when it happened or before the fact.
Well, before the fact. Well, now you're getting into the prediction thing again. I can call a bear market and where the bottom is after it happened.
Was.
So, predictions are easily the easiest when they're about the past. But those are post-dictions. Not. Go ahead.
So, what we've got is a bear market and... That's just the reality of it. The 10-year Treasury note did something odd, though, this week. It bounced around. Well, actually, not as odd as what the oil prices did, but the 10-year Treasury note bobbed around like a yo-yo. The Fed announced, obviously, a 0.75% increase in their base rate. Now, that was the big headlines. That's supposedly what scared the market, and not just the U.S. market, all over the world. This happened. And to show that they were serious about dealing with inflation, which, by the way, is now worse in United Kingdom than it is here. So it's an interesting thing. This is a different set of inflation than we've seen in anybody's lifetime that I know of. This is a different everything than we've seen and I've only been doing this 40 years. And before that, I was an investor. So I actually remember all the way back to the 1973 bear market, 73 through 75. And this is different. So the one thing we can look at history and we can say, here's typically what happens in history. Here's the averages. Here's this and here's that. What we can't say is based on those patterns, what's going to happen in the future. Now, what we can say some things though. We can understand the basic rules of economics. We can understand supply and demand. We can understand a lot about what causes major recessions and major bear markets. And we're going to talk about that today, hopefully. Let's see, the oil. We talked about oil prices. Oil prices, West Texas Intermediate crude oil fell 9% to $110, which is good.
Even Brent came down 7%.
Right. So I'm $110, by the way, per barrel is pretty close to what was predicted before Russia invaded Ukraine.
Right.
So Yeah, it's gasoline and diesel prices are going to be high. And the reason gasoline and diesel prices are so high is because Russian diesel and gasoline is very much unavailable in the European Union right now in other places. And so the price went up because of the law of supply and demand. What's the law of supply and demand? When demand goes up and supply goes down, prices go up. That is, you can't mess with that one. That's reality. And we have a drop in supply of petroleum because Russia is being nasty and naughty. And we have an increase in demand because we're coming out of the pandemic in the Western world and we're burning more fuel. And that's the big cause of inflation.
A couple of other things that, I mean, why is oil price, why are they going, why is it going down right now? The war is going on. Why? What's going on? Well, there's some answers to that. I know it's
in
weird.
Oklahoma.
Answers is in Oklahoma?
Yeah, the answer is in Cushing, Oklahoma.
That's one of the places. I was actually going to go to the Baker Hughes report on the rig count.
Well, you can use Baker and I'll use Cushing.
Okay. The rig count. So you're talking about the amount of oil we have on hand. It's like how much, how much is sitting in the tank?
Well, yeah, I'm not on hand. If you get oil on your hands, it's really
sticky. And but you can tell if it's sweet or not. I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get crude with you. Told you all my puns leave dents. All right. So last week we had about 874 rigs online in North America, which was up by about the last week we were up about 12 rigs from the week before. We'd been flat for a while. Well, this week we're at 896. That's 22 more rigs online this week. And this is what I was talking about last week, is that the rigs are coming online faster right now. All the prep work that needs to be done, they've got to move equipment out there. All that stuff has to take place to get oil wells functional again. Even when you're talking about fracking, you have to do refreshing. It takes time and we're limited on manpower, woman power, people power.
So you're saying the rig rate.
Yeah, the rig rate. It's been rigged. So I'm saying, I don't know if you can trust the rig numbers. They are by definition. okay, so what does that mean? A year ago, we had 587 rigs functional, according to Baker Hughes. These are rotary rigs. We're not talking about fracking here. These are the ones that you see pumping up and down, and they're not even the ones that you would normally see on the sides of the road. They're the big, big ones. Baker Hughes is measuring the more like the field that the rig is in than the rig itself. So 896 up 22 is phenomenal. A year ago, just to give you a comparison, how many rigs are in the Gulf of Mexico, according to Baker Hughes? Well, a year ago, there was supposed to be 13, and now there's supposed to be 15. Anybody that goes on a flight from Houston knows that there's a lot more than 15 oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. They're talking about kind of oil fields and a conglomerate of these things. And what that comes down to is we're having an incredibly fast upward movement in the number and of pumpers and the capacity that we have to produce oil. We're not at capacity yet in our refineries. So we're importing more crude oil right now than we have for several years at the top of the market, or really high in the market. We're bringing crude oil in because that's the most profitable time to refine it. And so all of that's good news for the long run, in that our capacity is coming back. We had about 1,200 rigs going, according to Baker Hughes, when the fracking boom was at its peak. So just to get back to there, we need about another 300 rigs to come online, which is about what we've done over the last year. So bringing another 300 online, our capacity is up. We're starting to see the oil prices come down. That's all good news. And I jumped in there because we were talking about oil, but have you finished with the market?
Well, I talked about oil. I talked about Treasury. I mentioned that in passing, but I didn't get into it. The United States Treasury note ended the week at 3.238%. Now, why is that important? Because at first, it's the benchmark for loaning in the United States. And it's up very substantially from where it was at the beginning of the year, and certainly wildly higher than it was a year ago, which is showing up in interest rates across the board. The average 30-year mortgage is now up to 5.85%. 5.58%. I'm a little dyslexic. And that is looks like it's slowing down the home starts and home purchases a little bit, which is good. The positive yield curve is still in place. It's not a very positive yield curve, which worries some people because some people like to worry. The 30-year...
That worries me when you say that. Hold on a minute. I'm a little triggered. Just that.
Well, in the newsletter, I miswrote.
You miswrote?
It says 30-year note in the newsletter, and actually it's a 30-year bond. Yeah. It's at 3.273%, which makes it higher than the 3.238% at 10 years, and then 3.184% at 2 years. Now, why is it important? Between 2 years and 30 years, if interest rates go up as the duration or the maturity gets longer, that's called a positive yield curve. And a positive treasury yield curve historically has indicated that we are in the next year very unlikely to have a recession.
Yeah. So it's a good sign for the economy that it's still positive. We haven't inverted yet.
Right. It is very, it's flat, which scares people. It's almost flat. But it is staying positive, and it's staying positive with a great deal of enthusiasm, which I like. Now, when you look at those rates and then you come all the way back down to the fact that the short-term Fed rate, the one that was raised this week, 1.75%. Short-term rates are still at 1.75%. And if you have had any experience with bank deposits or short-term rates or T-bills, you realize that is still astonishingly low. Short-term borrowing rates are very, very low. The market is not reacting to the fact that short-term borrowing rates are too high, because they're not. In an environment that we have right now, where if you use the core PCE index, I know that sounds like Greek to some people, but that's the one the Fed uses to determine what real inflation is, which is a little over 6%. If you can borrow money at 1.75% while inflation is running along at 6%, you're doing pretty good. The bank, whoever you borrowed that money from, is in effect paying you 4.25% to borrow the money. Now, when the short-term interest rates get as high as inflation, that's neutral. When short-term interest rates get above inflation, that is going to slow the economy down. So, frankly, the people who are panicking because the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, short-term interest rates, 0.75%, you must be kidding. We're still, the short-term interest rates the Fed has are still what we call stimulative. They're still stimulating the economy. So,
they're not stimulative for the zombie companies that can't afford to pay the higher interest. They're not stimulative compared to people that are used to getting nearly free money. But this is a pretty clear statement here. The high end of the average 30-year mortgage right now is about 6.25. The low end is still about 4.5. 6.25 as a percentage for an interest rate on a mortgage sounds extremely high, because a couple of years ago, it was less than half of that. But when you look back through history, 6.25 is an extremely low rate. People are used to having money easy. When it's slightly harder, but still easy, they look at it as a pain. It's still stimulative. It still should cause people to be able to afford a home if they can negotiate the price down. That's the big if. But that was kind of a wander around on what you were talking about.
That's what we're talking about. That's good. We have some questions, and I want to get to the questions, but I want to get the big thing said that I would like to get said for the next 2 hours here if we don't say anything else.
Wait a minute. We're not going to say anything else?
Well, we are going to say a lot of things else.
It's going to be very boring if we don't talk. It's just just saying.
Yeah, I got you. Okay. The United States, what's different about this situation right now as opposed to the late 1990s or 2007, just before a major recession and a major bear market, or 1973 for that matter? U.S. households are sitting on a record level by percentage of total income of savings. Now,
yeah,
we there's actually some questions on that and we can talk about it a little bit. Sure, if you're very low education and been unemployed a long time, and you were in poverty before the pandemic, and you're probably still in poverty, and you probably don't have a lot of money in the bank, but you're also probably not listening to this radio program. The total savings in the bank or money market fund cash is still very, very high in the United States. The other side of that coin, the short-term high interest debt of people in the United States is as low as it's been in 40 years or lower as so a percentage. That's like
credit cards at a high interest rate. So we have low credit card debt and high savings.
There's one exception to this, but generally speaking, mortgages really don't count as debt. That's carrying cost on a house. Now, during the great real estate speculation that went on in the in 2005 through 2007, that wasn't true because people were borrowing money in hope of flipping a house, and they would set up payments they couldn't afford to make. That's not going on. That's not going on at all. As a matter of fact, the houses that are being bought as investments right now are generally being bought with cash.
Yeah, it's near a majority. So it's like 48% of the houses being purchased right now are being purchased with cash.
So we don't have a high debt load on the consumer, and the consumer is about 70% of the American economy. So if you're going to have a recession, the consumer really is the driver in whether you're going to have a recession. So the consumers in the United States, the people who are buying stuff and driving the economy, do not have high debt loads. They do not have low savings. So those two items are the prerequisites for a major recession. Does that mean we won't get a recession? Well, technically, it's entirely possible that the second quarter, the one we're in right now, of this year, will have a negative GDP, but it will be a technical negative, not a factual negative. What's a technical negative? If we import more stuff than we export, that subtracts from GDP. Year-over-year inflation subtracts from GDP. But if people still have plenty of money and they're still buying things and businesses are not failing and people are not getting laid off, you can say that's a recession all you want to, but it ain't. I like the definition of recession I heard many, many years ago. A recession is when your neighbor loses his job.
A depression is when you lose yours.
Right. Yeah. That's it. There we go. That's the definition. And I ain't lost my job yet. Well, first somebody have to employ me. But yeah, it's really hard to lose your job when you're unemployed. Jake and I
structurally unemployed. We haven't been looking for work for so long. According to the government, we qualify as being unemployed because we're self-employed.
Right. Well, the difference between self-employed and unemployed is purely a state of mind.
And since we've lost ours, we're not sure what state it's in or if it's in a state.
I think it's in Texas.
Yeah.
But somewhere in West Texas at any rate. Anyway, that's the story of the market. And that's the story of a lot of stuff. And we've got a bunch of good questions. Yeah.
Do you mind if I take the first one? Unemployment.
Okay, go for it. Sure.
Okay. Inquisitor John, thank you very much for your faithful inquisition. You have questioned us, and they're generally really good. And this week you've got some phenomenal questions. The first question, the subject of the email is unemployment. And as is tradition, we have a digital picture emailed of the paper Wall Street Journal, so that we have analog converted to digital so that we can look at it with our eyeballs. The question is unemployment. Please explain how canceling a want ad will help reduce inflation. He's got an article from the Wall Street Journal that says higher joblessness looms as Fed shifts. And there's a section circled where it says Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and other officials suggested earlier this year that they might be able to reduce demand for labor, a source of inflation pressure, primarily by prodding employers to cut job vacancies rather than by laying off workers and pushing up unemployment. So The question here is, what does that have to do with inflation? What are job vacancies, and how could the Federal Reserve put a pressure on a corporation to reduce job vacancies rather than lay people off? It's kind of philosophical in some ways. There are benefits when you hire someone new, and there are benefits for keeping people on hand. Well, you're about to say something, so what would you
like? I just wanted to comment on the question.
Okay, go ahead.
Why, the article is pointing out that what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is get people, it's all these unfilled jobs that employers are advertising for. They're trying to shrink the unfilled jobs that employers are advertising for. What is that? As long as a worker working for a company looks at the unemployment list and says, there's lots of high paying jobs that I could go to, so I'm going to demand a higher wage from my employer because there's lots of job openings out there. And if you don't give me a higher wage, I'm going to leave. That causes their wage to be raised without them producing more. That will drive inflation over time.
Yeah. So what they were suggesting earlier this year is that if a company was about to go looking for someone to fill a job, that they should look within their own workforce first. If they're about to lay somebody else off because they're not qualified for a job and they happen to be qualified for one you're about to put a job listing out for, it's more efficient just to hire them internally. You don't have to fire them and rehire them, just move them to the other job. Well, there's a little overlap here because the question is, what does this have to do with inflation? It is inflationary to be posting these want ads because you see, you know, we saw the great resignation is what the Wall Street Journal labeled so far the end of 2021 to about now, where people are quitting at a high rate because there are good job openings out there. The competition for their pay is there. Well, that's an upward pressure on pay, which means that the company has to pay more money to the employees, which means that they likely have to start charging more for whatever it is that they make. That's an inflationary spiral, but it's a really kind of indirect one. Where this is weird is that there's an overlap here. The Fed has a lot of mandates, but two major ones. And we spend a lot of time talking about the number one major one, which is protecting the buying power of our currency, preventing inflation and deflation beyond unreasonable amounts. So they have a target on what they want for inflation. The second mandate, though, is to have a low unemployment, to protect the let me see, what is it exactly that it says? It is to mission of the Federal Reserve is let's see, it's got a dual mandate, a price stability and maximum sustainable employment. Okay, they've got other mandates too, but these are the ones that are actually written into the law, that the Federal Reserve, it also does things like it maintains an effective, reliable payment system. It supervises and regulates banking operations and establishes monetary policies. Its mandates are to protect our buying power. Don't let the dollar value go up and down drastically inside the United States. We want to know what our prices are. We want them to be stable. And we also don't want a lot of unemployment. So when they're raising interest rates, you're seeing in the news layoffs in tech. The tech sector is having layoffs. Tesla's laying off and Coinbase is laying off. I'm not sure I'd call them tech. I don't want to say what I'm not allowed to say what I think they are on the air, actually, because we could get fined for that. But when you go through a list of these high-flying stocks over the last year and you see a lot of layoffs going on, is it possible that they could have prevented themselves from hiring at these high rates early in the year and not done the layoffs now? Probably. And that's what the Federal Reserve was trying to get ahead of. So the dual mandate there is the extra hiring they did at the beginning of the year added to the pressure for other tech companies to hire at higher wages and added to the pressure to lay people off when things that are happening today come into focus. So it's kind of part of the dual mandate. It's not just inflation. It's also about, hey, you can prevent some unemployment by not laying that person off. If you're looking for things that they already know how to do, just move them over to the other position.
Yeah, that's the end of that.
Yeah, that was a long-winded answer. But I really enjoyed that question because the Federal Reserve's mandates, we forget about unemployment being part of it. They've done a really good job on that. His next one, do you mind if I do the Social Security one too?
John, sure, go ahead.
We've got some great ones here. John's next question is called Social Security Interest. And there's another Wall Street Journal article. And in it, it says, Congress has earned about 1.5% on the trillions of dollars it has confiscated from workers, meaning in the Social Security Trust Fund with air quotes around it. Taxes are confiscating money. This is obviously an opinion piece just to begin with. Confiscating from, it sounds like that's not what their job is. That's Congress's main role is to tax us. I don't like it, but that's its main role. Had Congress invested the money in government bonds, the return would have averaged 3% and 5% invested in high grade corporate bonds. If they'd put it in equities, they would have reached 9% a year. Had any of these returns been realized, Social Security would now be solvent and 1,000 more Americans would have retired as millionaires. So this is a letter to the editor. Okay, so his question is, assuming this is true, what does the government invest in to get such low rates? Is there a law or rule that prohibits the government from being more aggressive and chase higher rates? They're going to Congress. They're loaning themselves money for this. This is it's called an interagency loan. It's an IOU from Congress to Congress. When Social Security money came in, they spent it in the general revenue and they wrote themselves an IOU. So they charged themselves 1.5%, but it's kind of like Enron claiming it had made a profit by charging itself interest on a loan. It's a wash. Go ahead.
John's quote for his question is from a letter to the editors.
Right.
The letter to the editor is incorrect.
It is incorrect. They didn't get 1.5%.
No, the Social Security Administration, the 12 monthly interest rates for 2019, which is the most recent we have available to us, was 2.219%. And I'm going to tell you something. Where in 2019 could you go get savings at 2.219% that were guaranteed? I thought that was a pretty good rate, personally.
The formula for how they do this, by the way, is a four-year maturing U.S. government securities average yield as of the beginning of June.
Okay?
So they don't do any four-year maturing securities. So you have to have these longer-term bonds and notes that are coming due in 4 years in June to get the rate. So you get things that were issued 20 years ago at higher interest rate, and you get things that were issued 10 years ago at not so higher interest rate averaged together. The kind of the big thing that I wanted to hit here is that if it had invested in equities, it would have reached 9% a year. Is there a law against this? Yes. Yes. The government is not allowed to go out and buy a bunch of the stock market. Would you want the United States government to own Google or General Motors? Let me choose a different term for General Motors. They actually did, but it required a federal judge and it required a lot of maneuvering in the law front for the United States government even to become the manager of General Motors, its trustee during its bankruptcy. So there are laws against it, and you certainly wouldn't want the United States government making decisions on what companies to buy and sell. Look what they did to medicine over that.
I saw an analysis back when, many years ago, when there was a push by the Republican Party and by the conservatives in Congress to take Social Security and invest it in the stock market. In other words, stop basically turn it into a 401k run by the government.
Right.
Here's the point. Had that occurred years and years ago before that, at this point, the stock market would be 2/3 owned by the federal government. And man, if you want socialism, there we go. Big time.
Yeah.
when the federal government owns two-thirds of the stock market, we you got call a that, serious you, problem, folks.
You call that Russia. You call that China. That's not who we are. The government doesn't have a business jumping into the stock market. They'd be voting shares. Do you want the government voting shares of companies that are trying to make a profit? I mean, even when you get pension funds that are activist related, that's the problem.
Oh, that would be a nightmare. And the Social Security Trust Fund has actually earned a pretty good interest rate over time. It is, as Jake said, there is a formula, and it has to do with the average maturity of regular U.S. Treasury notes. And it's not a bad, basically it is prudent investing. And yes, it is, you're getting paid interest on your Social Security, and that's really nice. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody has come to the retirement period and come to their full retirement age or whatever and says, pay me my Social Security, and the government come back and say, I'm sorry, we did a bad investment. We put a lot of money in Enron. Or so you only get 30% of your Social Security.
I mean, El Salvador did a really good deal. They just bought a lot of Bitcoin back at the very top of the market. It was great. And now they're wondering if they're going to default on debt.
Right.
Whoops.
Speaking of Bitcoin, I've been thinking about it. We haven't said anything about it. We were talking about the market. Bitcoin, from the beginning, well, let's put it like this. Let's look at a couple of things. The Coinbase issue.
Yeah. Coinbase is a publicly traded company. We are not recommending that you buy or sell it.
Right. Coinbase was like $280 a share at the end of last year. It's 58 now, which should tell you something about what's going on in the crypto market. Bitcoin is down about 70%+ so far this year.
Well, you don't have to be cryptic about it.
And that doesn't count the many, and I could say many several more times, people who have had money in exchanges, not money, they've had their Bitcoins in exchanges like we saw this week, and they can't get it out. Now, Coinbase was a place you could, if you had a crypto wallet, and you had, let's say you had $10,000 or $100,000 in crypto, you could loan it to Coinbase. Coinbase would use it as collateral for loans. They would loan money to people and pay you high interest rates. And apparently a lot of people did that. And this last week, something very significant happened. If you had your crypto in Coinbase and you said, I want my money back. Basically, it's like you loaned your money to the Coinbase bank, because it's a crypto bank, is what it really is. And you said, I'd like to have my money back. They said, oh, I'm sorry, we're not allowing any withdrawals due to the market conditions.
Yeah. So this is happening in Babel and Celsius. I wasn't aware that Coinbase had done a freeze on withdrawals, but it wouldn't surprise me, because there's a lot of exchanges that are saying, hey, we've got Bitcoin stuck. That's their term for it. There's a transaction that's stuck. So you can't do any withdrawals. That's a little scary. It's more than a little scary. No, so, I don't think that we can say crypto is dead. It usually takes quite a lot of massive crashes for pie in the sky ideas to go away. But, you know, maybe it is. Maybe people have had enough of this. Maybe they want to buy something that actually has a potential of making something profitable that people will buy, rather than hoping that someone else will buy the thing they bought for more.
Anyway, yes. Anyway, that's we've had this thing about crypto for a long time, and we think it's a bad idea.
Yes, we've said it for a long time. Now I know people. I have great relationships with people who have made a tremendous amount of money in crypto.
Or have they just seen their crypto go up?
I know people that have actually sold out of crypto to buy houses and things like that with.
Cool.
Unfortunately, they then took a mortgage on their house to buy more crypto. So people have, it's kind of like Vegas, where everybody makes money in Vegas. They just generally don't leave with the money that they make. They lost that before they came home.
Crypto is very similar to Vegas, going to a casino. And there are going to be some winners, and you're going to hear about them. It's similar to playing the lottery. It's a good way to lose a lot of money. A very few people will make a lot of money, and a very large number of people will lose a lot of money. It is a sub-zero based system.
What is a sub-zero based system?
A zero based system would be like if you're playing cards with your buddies, and you have, if you take the total amount of money that was put in there for bets, and the total amount of money that people took out as winnings or retentions that they kept, it's a zero. I mean, there's no gain, there's no loss. It just money shifted from one person to another.
Yeah,
to
put it in a different way, it's kind of like a poker table.
Right, that's what I was referring to.
The only money that you can win is money that somebody else put on the table. It isn't producing its own money. It's not creating something of value that people are willing to pay for. It's just the pot, and that pot only gets bigger when people put money in, and it only gets smaller when people take money out.
And there are sub-zero systems. The casino is a sub-zero system. In other words, less money is won than is gambled because the casino makes money.
Right.
Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are sub-zeros because there are exchanges, there are people in the middle who are making money, but there's no value being added. And you just can't do it. On the other hand, the stock market in general represents companies.
Can we put a timeout just a second when we say there's no value being added? Both of us have said that. What does that mean? The question is, what does Bitcoin do? What does it create? If you're buying a company, hopefully it's doing something that's profitable. It's making something that people are willing to buy. A coin, whether it's a gold coin or a collectible like a Bitcoin, it's worth what someone's willing to pay you for it, but it's not underneath it producing anything. It's not a representation of an ownership of something that's trying to create stuff. It's just a collectible. Okay, back to you.
That's basically what I was going to say. The stock market, generally speaking, is companies that people invest in. They give them money. The companies then turn around and majority of them make a profit. And when they make a profit, it's because they have added value to something. They have taken something that is a low value. They have processed it. They have manufactured. They have provided services. They've done something, but they've added value to it. And when they add the value to it, they make a profit. That's what adding value does. And the owners of the company then legitimately can claim a profit in the value of that company. That increases everybody. Everybody's ship is floated higher, in Adam Smith's term. The rising tide raises all ships. And those are solid value-based investments. Now, solid. Shoot, they can go under, and sometimes there's scams like Enron pulled off and Madoff. Well, Madoff wasn't in stocks. But there's a world of difference between investing in something that is not creating what we call utility. It's not creating value in the economy, and investing something that is creating value in the economy. And Bitcoin does not create value in the economy. We have a question about the household savings rate. And he said that he's heard again and again and again that most families couldn't pay a $400 emergency if they had one, and they're living paycheck to paycheck. There's a good publication that came out in 2021 from the Federal Reserve. In 2013, that was true. In 2013, in an emergency, if an emergency came up, only 50% of the families, a $400 emergency, only 50% of the families in the United States would be able to pay for it out of cash reserves. However, in July 2020, which is the most recent data we have, 70% of American households would be able to pay that $400 emergency. So we've gotten a lot better than we were as recently as 2013. It's been steadily rising.
Yeah, the end of 2021, it was 78%. Now we're at...
You got something newer than
I do. Wait a minute. At the end of 2021, it was 68%. Now it's at 70%. You can see this rise, very slow rise of more and more of the population can handle an emergency based on what they have in the bank.
So basically, we said that households have $62,000 is the average household savings position right now, which is amazingly high. And it has been rising for lower income and higher income people, at least since 2013, very nicely. Sure, there's 12% of the population that if they had a $400 emergency expense, wouldn't know where to get the money. The poor will always be with you, unfortunately. And if people have very low education and they just got laid off, they probably are in a world of hurt.
And that's something we see in the statistics. It's repeated that if you have less than a high school education and you were unemployed over the last 6 months, you're less likely to be able to meet a $400 emergency. That seems common sense to me, but that is what's being stated.
Yeah. And we are at the last minute. So yeah. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact, we do manage investments for people. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we can be reached voicemail on the weekends, live people answering the phone on the week at 254-947-1111.
Or toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where we have newsletters that you can sign up for or just simply read there. You can listen to radio programs going back lots of years. You can get podcasts there or anywhere else that podcasts are provided. Our contact form is there, but you can also email us directly at Jeff and Jake at tpwc.com.